Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
One of the more talked about topics at Milken this year is, yes, we've been talking about the regional banks, but we have talked a lot, and maybe even more so, about what's going on in commercial real estate in general. Yesterday, I had an all-star lineup on real estate, including this gentleman next to me. Sean Dobson is Chairman, CEO, and Chief Investment Officer at Amherst. They've got $17.6 billion in assets under management. I think that was at the end of last year. They're buying, they're renovating homes, they're investing in single-family rentals, mortgage-backed securities, and commercial real estate. So, man, this is the person to talk to when it comes to real estate.
Hold on.
Let's manage expectations.
Expectations better than that, please.
Go wherever you want. Good to see you again.
Very good to see you.
So I know we're going to rehash some of the stuff we talked about on our panel, but you know, coming out of the great financial crisis, you took what was a difficult environment, but it was really opportunistic for you, correct?
It was.
Helped build your company. Talk to us about that time, and maybe is it, you know, how you think about some of the crises people are talking about now. Is it
sure?
Similar?
Yeah, that's always the question. Is this another 2008? So for us, it was interesting. The roots of our firm are actually in analyzing mortgages, which is pretty boring. So we can kind of put everyone to sleep talking about a 30-year fixed rate mortgage.
But data is important.
But data is very important, and we tackled this sort of over 25 years, where we stopped thinking about the mortgage market in general and started thinking about each mortgage. And each house. And so now with, you know, with data and analytics and the scale of our operation, we can sort of weave together the story of what's going on with the 80 to 100 million real estate parcels in the world, and then look at sort of the larger, bigger trends. And so with the financial crisis, for us, it was all about understanding the level of credit risk that was built up in the market that was really heavily dependent on home prices continuing to outperform. Mm-hmm. And so we positioned our clients into sort of really asymmetric return trades that benefited from housing underperforming. Now, this is not 2008 today.
Yeah.
Not at all, right? Not at all. I mean, you've got a very different infrastructure. But one of the things that came out of 2008 was very difficult for the average American family to get a mortgage. So we were sitting around the table in 2009, kind of exhausted from anticipating it and then, you know, the mess that had occurred. And we thought about, what is the next? And this is what Amherst does. We don't do sort of run in and buy something and hope it appreciates. We're like, what's the next thing that we can do to provide a lot of service to a lot of people for a trade that's very durable?
Yeah.
And we thought about what's going to happen to all these homes. Families still need to live in the homes. They need the type of amenities that a home presents, the school district, and that type of thing. The things that multifamily maybe doesn't do a great job providing. They need this type of real estate, but if they can't get a mortgage, how are they going to live in this real estate? So around post-financial crisis, okay, let's figure it out. And so we built a national platform that does all of the basics, that leverages off of all of our technology. We already were pricing the home and thinking about the home as an investment. And so we said, okay, how do we activate this investment when really it's a lot of granular decisions of an acquisition, an underwrite, a repair. So we built a national general contracting. I never thought that Amherst would end up owning trucks with people running around fixing air conditioners.
Well, that's what's interesting, right? I mean, because it's rental a lot.
It's rental.
Right?
Yeah, so in the U.S. about two-thirds of people own their home, which is pretty good for a global comparison of home ownership versus rentership. But that means about a third of American families are living in a home that they're leasing. And I spent the first sort of two-thirds of my career helping and participating in the mortgage market and helping people own. And I spent about the last third of my career, the most recent third, hopefully not the last third, the most recent third of my career focused on that rental segment. So that, you know, there's such a big market. You're talking about 15 million families live in a separately detached home
right.
that they're leasing from an owner-operator. And of those, there's only like a half a dozen of us that are big owner-operators. The rest of them are owned by individual investors.
Does that continue in terms of the amount of people that are in rental? And, you know, some of the things that came up on the panel show and I thought was really interesting, we talked about demographics, right? Older yep. folks, they're not leaving their homes. They don't want to leave that 3% mortgage or 4% or whatever, to, you know, that low mortgage. But there are some things going on. So does that stay, does that continue where people don't buy a home?
I think it does. I think it's here to stay. I think that there's a little consumer preference at stake here. Owning a home means sort of committing to stay in one location for a longer period of time. We see less of that. About a quarter of our residents move out every year.
Wow.
So some of this is, it's not time to buy. Some of this, it's very difficult to buy. And we have to provide them the type of services that they're accustomed to coming out of multifamily, where you have a lot more professional management.
Right.
So I think there will be a lot more growth in the rental segment. One of the things I have to point out, you just pointed out something super important that most people haven't really fully adjusted for yet, I don't think. So my dad is 85 years old. He's fantastic. He's still the smartest guy in the room. When my father was born in 1937, the life expectancy for a male in the U.S. and the U.K. was 63 years. So he's outperformed, which we love. But today...
Go dad.
Go dad. So today, a male born in the U.S. or U.K. has a life expectancy of 83 years.
Yeah.
So that 20-year expansion life expectancy is a third, and that changes everything. And one of the things that changed was how real estate gets recycled back into the market. So the U.S., we have a decade of underinvesting in real estate, and then we have the use case extending. And then on the front side, we have more people choosing to rent or requiring to rent because right. of what happened to the GFC. So you can just kind of see there's a lot of tailwinds behind the asset class.
This is what I find fascinating about housing. Like mm-hmm. the supply demand, it's so basic, but it really...
It's not that complicated. Now you have to have the demand, the supply where people want the demand. This is another issue.
Yeah.
Another big issue is the age of our housing stock. The average home in the United States is built in 1977. It's got less than 8-foot ceilings, and it's got one bathroom for every 3 bedrooms.
I grew up in a house in the 1950s. Don't even ask me.
Well, anyway. That's not the product that people want today. And so we have this unbelievable business that takes that home and modernizes it and basically recycles it.
Well, I guess what I'm also curious about is what happened to the oversupply of housing coming off the great financial crisis, where people were talking about blowing up houses,
right.
you know, increasing immigration so that immigrants could buy homes. Like, what happened to that oversupply?
We bought it.
We did.
Because it wasn't the supply-demand imbalance, what they thought about them was, geez, we lost a lot of our consumers that were going to buy. But what we realized is that you didn't lose the fact that people want to live there.
Right.
But someone has to institutionalize the equity supply to that home. So how do you get scaled equity into these micro assets? And so that's the challenge that we took on. That's the kind of thing we like to do.
So what do you do with home? Like, so talk about the building side of it. So, all right, yep. if we need more supply,
yep.
I think one of the things that also came up on the panel is that there's not workers there that you need to necessarily build these homes.
Yeah, there are so many multiple variables that make housing so expensive to manufacture. About 2/3 or maybe 60% of a home that's built on site,
right.
the cost is labor. We point out to people that there are more barrels of oil in a home than there are sticks and timber. So that,
what do you mean?
Just transportation cost of all the materials and the people. And so you have to form up this construction site every day and then take it down when you're building homes on site. So we've really gone deep in trying to understand what can we do to bring down the cost of housing. One of the things we're doing, we're innovating, is a new type of factory
mm-hmm.
where it's the same home you would build on site, but it's built modularly.
Yeah.
And then our labor pool is quite different. We have tradesmen that are, you know, they're really able to perfect what they do to build the home. And then we can sort of, if you will, export the labor cost of a small town into the real estate market of a big town. So it really unlocks, it's American manufacturing jobs. It allows us to create really good, high-paying jobs
right.
in towns that maybe don't have as much opportunity.
How much of that is going on? That's fascinating.
It's been around for a long time.
And modular, right.
Modular's been around a long time, but we think that we've uncovered a little bit of what's happened to the market. Look, the housing, the industry is to build a home and sell it.
Right.
Or preferably sell a home and then build it, right? So they don't have a long demand function for their manufacturing base. So imagine if BMW or General Motors waited for you to order a car before they started the factory every day.
Right.
That's how the U.S. housing market works. They don't have an elongated demand cycle, and there's a lot of price risk in the asset itself, as we're seeing today. So what we think we can do by having an opportunity to either sell the home or provide the home as a rental and have capital for that asset available for years in advance. We were striking capital relationships with global investors that last 5, 7, 10 years. So now we can create a really reliable long-term capital base for the asset before it's built.
Rental, the business of being in renting homes versus building and selling, what's more profitable?
It depends on where you are in the cycle. The big thing that we point out to people is that you need to have a monetization strategy that moves with interest rates.
Yeah.
And if you're just building them to sell, and like you're in affordability is really a difficult thing right now.
Right.
All of a sudden, the home builder gets concerned about their takeout, and they have to shrink their capacity. So I think that the winning strategy is going to be get manufacturing right, and then let the capital markets provide you a longer term, more stable exit price for your product.
All right, so affordability is tough right now, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people can't afford a home. Yep. You've got higher mortgage rates, which dampens buying. So give me an idea of what you're anticipating, like the dynamics that are sometimes conflicting, strange that are out there. What does it mean for the residential housing market in the next 6 to 12 months in terms of demand and pricing? And
sure.
And I know it's location.
We have our view. Yeah, exactly. It's location dependent for sure, but the thing you can think about is incomes grew a lot, and that really grew affordability. Now interest rates have risen a lot, and that takes away affordability. What we think about this is that the marginal home sale is what determines the price. So you have the stock of homes, then you have the flow of homes.
Right.
The flow is down 50% because about 70% of U.S. homeowners went out and were able to refinance into a mortgage that was sub 4%. So that means that 70% of the 60% of homes, so maybe 40-50% of all the homes in the country, the person living there would literally have to double their mortgage payment to replace the same home.
Mm-hmm.
So in the mortgage world, we call this the lock-in effect, when a group of homeowners are really disincentivized from moving. So think about what that does to supply. It brings down, so we can't really see home prices fall just because rates went up, because there's really no homes for sale. In the meantime, I think overall, we may be underestimating how much incomes grew. So houses may not be as unaffordable as they were, but there's definitely a case of a strange statistic today that even we can't tell you how this is going to turn out.
Yeah.
But ordinarily, if you were to lease a home versus buying the home, your monthly payment would be a little bit higher. And that's because the person leasing the home has to take on repairs and maintenance.
Right.
Right. So if you buy the home, you take on the responsibilities. So your principal, interest, taxes, and insurance would be slightly lower than your rental payment. That's inverted now. It's inverted significantly. It's way cheaper to rent than it is to buy because you just had this shock to the system. So we think that probably will correct itself over time. It may correct from rents rising. But you mentioned before about sort of locations and location and pricing. One of the things that we're really, really after, this is not exactly ingenious, people need to be able to afford the product. So our rents are sort of below 25% of our
business school the first year.
Exactly. try to sell something your customers can afford. Ding, ding. So for us, we're sort of enthused by the fact that our rents are about a quarter of the family's gross income. And that makes them really sustainable. And it means they can float as income drives.
It's interesting. So let me go back to, all right. So then what worries you about the outlook?
Well, look, you have this crazy cross current now to where in our view, there was too much fiscal support to the economy.
Right.
Of an overreaction. Now you have the Federal Reserve sort of counterbalancing that with what we would argue was way too fast a reaction in monetary policy. So what this does is it just slows down the velocity of capital. So we think in 10, 20, 30-year cycles, we think about affordability, we think about rent growth, income growth, national growth, what happens to each city. And now you just have a point in time where everyone is a little bit nervous to make a big decision because you only get to capitalize your investment in these things once, and you're not sure, are they going to be less expensive tomorrow or more expensive tomorrow? And when you just have this much uncertainty in the market, you can see it in quoted volatility, you can see it in the shape of the yield curve. What the real result of all this is, people just don't do anything. So I think the thing that concerns us is just if capital becomes, there's really no longer a penalty for not being invested, and so it just slows down long-term capital formation.
We've just got about 45 seconds left here. So you're the residential guy that was on the panel. I mean, you guys do mortgage-backed securities. You do some commercial. I'm just curious your take on office since you're...
Yeah. So we're in there. We have a portfolio
of
loans.
Yeah.
We have some loans that have defaulted, and we've taken some properties over. And I spent the last year really working closely with our team to understand what the alternative use cases are for office. Suburban office probably has more flexibility than urban office.
Okay.
And so the suburban offices, we're taking some down and putting back logistics centers. And so it's really like
logistics centers.
Too much supply, and it's real estate. We can take it down.
Does the data tell you that there's more pain to come?
A lot more pain to come.
A lot more pain to come. A bust?
Sorry. Well, I mean, look, a lot of the pain's already here. The only question is how long before y'all recognize.
But is it again like the lower tier that we talked about on the panel? Just quick.
There's like this top 1% of the office market. Everyone brags about one Vanderbilt and $200 rents. That's interesting, but not really important.
Thank you so much. See, it flew. You were worried and you kept your voice. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Fun to have you on the panel. Fun to have you back here. Sean Dobson, Chairman, CEO, and Chief Investment Officer at Amherst, right here on Bloomberg.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern.
Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Or watch us live on YouTube.
Carol Masser along with Jess Menton. She's back at our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. I'm here live in Beverly Hills at the Milken Institute Global Conference. I'm reading from a book. And here's what it says. Those first weeks at United were a frenzy of nonstop activity. From the moment I walked into the office on my first day to the moment my heart stopped 37 days later. This book is called Turnaround Time, Uniting an Airline and Its Employees in the Friendly Skies. And it's written by Oscar Munoz. He's the former CEO of United Airlines, which then became United Continental and then back to United. He was also executive chairman at United. Oscar, it is so wonderful. I wish I was back in our studio with you. And I know you're there with Jess. Congratulations on the book. It's very personal. And you talk about your time at United. Tell us a little bit about when you landed, no pun intended, as CEO in 2015. It was 5 years after their merger. What was top of mind? What were you seeing?
Thanks. Thanks for having me, both of you. It's great to see you. And I listen to you guys quite a bit, so it's good to see you personally. I had a lot of insight into the business only because I was on the board. But as we all know, being on the board and leading something is a very different situation. So even in a short few days, as I met and I traveled, I could sense, you know, there were smiles and adulation and people wanting to say hello, but there was always this kind of this lingering, holding on to a sleeve sort of thing, and look at, like, almost without being dramatic, you know, help me, help us sort of thing. So I could sense something. And I think my first interview, I used the terms, I'm finding our team disillusioned, disenfranchised, and disengaged. You know, the three D's, just because these flew. And I also said, I'm a little embarrassed as a board member that we didn't see this before. And so that's what I found, to your question. And then, of course, lots of things happened. Everybody wants to know what you're going to do first. Well, and I thought I would ask my team rather than myself.
All right. There's a lot, I'm sure, of conversations and talking to your team. 1 month in, though, you did suffer a near-fatal heart attack. I can't even imagine some of the things that you were dealing with personally, professionally. Give us a little bit of what that was like. I read a little bit of a passage from your book, but I just can't even imagine. Take us again back there.
You know, it's every time I begin to talk about it, or certainly when I write about it, all of that comes back to you, because heart disease is the biggest killer in America by far. The symptoms are varied and wide. Difference between men and women, and unfortunately what a lot of people do is they just ignore those signs. And you know, we take a shower, we lay down, and of course never to be done. So I was fortunate to have a good friend who's a cardiologist who I did a lot of, again, I trained for, you know, we ran marathons, we did long bike rides. I mean, so I was fit, I was a vegan, but he'd always kind of warn us that heart disease is not optics, it's internal plumbing. And one day in particular, he said something to the degree that, listen, if you ever feel anything weird, call 911. The worst you can be is embarrassed. And then he added something that I remembered those a couple years later when I had my event, when he said, when you call 911, he said, immediately tell them where you are. which, like, duh, of course, that makes sense. But then he added, because you may not make it past the phone call. And I remember exactly where I was, and I'm thinking, okay, Mike, that's a little dramatic. But 2 years later, I'm sitting there having my vegan protein shake after a run, and my phone buzzes, and I go to move it, and my legs sort of give out. I feel clammy, and his words came rushing back. I crawled over to the landline. Some of you may know what that is. And called 911 and told him immediately where I was. So 37 days into the job, and again, in a story you really can't make up, 37 minutes later, I was in the hospital, and I was on life support on a heart, artificial heart lung machine, because I had my heart had gotten pretty blown up.
And how did this end up basically transforming your career, as well as how you ended up managing United through what Carol was just talking about, this huge transformation between 2015 up until early in the pandemic when you were still CEO?
So, you know, the few days, the 37 days before the event, the heart event, I got a chance to meet a lot of the people at United, what became pretty immediately my family. So to your question, there's two things that happened, not quite transformational, but certainly ratifying. The outpouring of love, support, kindness, food, flowers, cards from all over the world from the United family was amazing. My kids would read those notes every day. So I confirmed what I had seen out there. These are wonderful people, but they're sort of wandering nomads in the desert, and there's no North Star for that. By the way, North Star is Polaris, and if you fly us, you know Polaris. So there's a history and a tie into everything. So the people
Nicely
were amazing.
Done.
The second thing for all of us out here, you know, this concept of mind over body and all that sort of stuff, I never once thought I was never coming back. I never once thought I was in any kind of serious situation. My doctors didn't agree with me.
Right. I mean, I'm surprised to hear you were a vegan and this happened. Typically, you'd think that would be obviously more healthy lifestyle.
Again, you know, heart disease is a genetic aspect. I didn't know my biological father, so I didn't have any of that history. So it's what's important for all of us. An EKG doesn't do anything. Stress tests do. There's more invasive process. And there's a lot of great new technology that's coming out that's going to be, if you think about breast cancer and the old way we used to, women used to do it. Now mammography comes in. There's new, as a company called Clearly that I'm involved with, that does, in essence, mammography for the heart. So there's a lot of ways to do that. But you know, the transformation was partly that, and partly the fact of I love this United team, and we knew we had to do something about it. And didn't change who I was, didn't change how I led. But of course, there's a level of gratitude that comes with surviving something like that.
So how did you create a culture that was better for employees, better for the company overall, and better for those who flew United?
This will be a shocking revelation. I did nothing but actually listen and learn from the tens of thousands of people that we have out in the field that take care of you, the people you see and the people that you don't see below the wing and in the maintenance facilities. The 37 days before, I was on a massive listening tour, and nothing structured, nothing deeply, academic or intellectual. It was just a human conversation. It's like, just tell me how it's going. Tell me what you can think. And I heard lots of different things. And in a very pivotal moment for the turnaround at United, I was on a flight with a flight attendant. I was on a flight, and I went and met and talked with the flight attendant. I said, "Hi, I'm Oscar," and she clearly did not want to talk to me.
Like, oh, really?
Sit down, go. I don't want. That's how far we had disengaged our folks. It's like, I don't want to listen. You know, why am I going to waste my breath? Right, over time, we had I don't know 5-6 CEOs in the last few years. What she said to me when I finally got her to open up, she just said, "Oscar, I'm just tired of always having to say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry the coffee sucks. I'm sorry we're late." And if you think about an individual that works for such a large global company who we embodied this concept of friendly skies, but everything was broken, and they are the ones that had to, in essence, apologize. That's how you lose human engagement. And so to your question, how we built the culture is just from that perspective, is just telling them, like, okay, employees, you don't have to do anything. I and this team have to regain your trust, and from that we're going to build what you see now at United.
Mm-hmm. So I am curious, you know, we're all flying around. People want to go out and experience things. The industry today, it can be stressful. Again, what is it that you think we could do better in the airline industry? And I think, I know you've, there's things you've talked about in terms of the type of fuel that's being used, because it certainly has a carbon imprint. We just have about a minute left. How do you think it can go to the next level, if you will?
I think two things. I think from a broader perspective, air traffic control in America is outdated and obsolete. If we don't start getting it fixed soon, like a lot of the other infrastructure, we're going to pay the price. I know it's easy to blame the airlines for a lot of the delays. We are often hampered by the fact that we can't put a lot of airplanes in the air because we can't effectively and safely monitor them without slowing everything down, A. And B, you know, a little caring goes a long way. You're not the only one that has something important to go to. And if you just kind of lay back a little bit, you know, have a little care. If somebody's in a wheelchair, you know, they're in a worse state than you. And I know they're holding you up, but it wouldn't be a bad thing if you just showed a little love and care.
Well, we're going to leave it on that note. Just great words. In a world where I think it's very trying on a lot of people, we certainly see it from the financial perspective, but just in general, there's a lot coming at people. And great to hear your story and to see, you know, what you personally and professionally have achieved. So, Oscar, thank you so much for spending some time with us. Oscar Munoz, he is, of course, the former CEO of United Airlines, executive chairman as well. And his new book is Turnaround Time, Uniting an Airline and Its Employees in the Friendly Skies. So some really, you know, just logical about how we can make things better. And it's amazing when you start listening to people, what you can find out. All right, Oscar, thank you so much.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern
on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube.
You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
The world's largest companies poised to face a 15% minimum tax under a 2021 deal to overhaul global tax rules as more countries begin to implement the measures. We're talking about more than or around 140 countries. So we wanted to get to some of the implications of it. And we're delighted to have with us Marna Ricker. She's Global Vice Chair of Tax at the consulting and advisory firm EY here at Milken. I do want to talk about that. First of all, welcome. Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Carol.
Great to have you here. Yeah. But, you know, before we started getting going, we were talking a little bit about what's being talked about at Milken. You said there's been some really interesting panels. What's jumped out at you?
Yeah, I have to tell you, there's, you know, I sort of feel like at the end of the day, things are going to get greener, right? We're looking for economic efficiency.
Right.
You know, I think that trade is going to be really interesting to see who emerges ultimately, what countries emerge, India, MENA, Africa, right?
It's moving around. Last conversation I just had was the same thing, that globalization isn't going away.
No.
It's going to be different.
That's exactly right. I really love that of, you know, China. You know, you were hearing people say decoupling from China. Now you're hearing them say de-risking, you know, or navigating with China. You know, you can't cut off trade with some of the largest economies in the world. And so I just, I feel a lot of optimism, frankly, more optimism maybe than I expected.
Did you go to any panels on real estate or on banking?
I went to banking. I stayed out of real estate. I won't predict there.
Well, talk to us about the implications, because another thing is, you know, I don't know that we talk tons about corporate tax structure and strategy, but it's a big deal.
It is.
So talk to us a little bit about this rule and companies that have joined on, or the countries that have joined on, and the implications of it.
Yep, for sure. I love good tax policy, and so I do look at, it's called
I love a person who loves good tax
policy. I do. I think it's a force for good, and I think it has the ability to drive, you know, behavioral change. And so what's interesting, I think, about
this is good leveling the playing field globally.
Yes, it is. That's exactly right. And so when you look at BEPS Pillar 2, that's what we're talking about here ultimately, starting in financial statements in 1/1/24, so for calendar year companies, they're going to get it under their rate. It really literally is about what is the minimum tax around the world look like, and so what are those tax collections going to look like? You know, and I also look at it with Pillar 1, which is much more about digital, you know, digital customer base, market rights to taxation. I look at that, this is all about modernizing the tax code.
Right.
We have a century-old tax code. It is a bricks and industrial type tax code, and we're in a really modern society that's extraordinarily digital.
When you say that, are you just talking about the corporate, or are you also talking about just overall?
Corporate. really about corporate. Yep.
As an individual, we got to do something.
Yeah, we got to do that too.
But we'll talk about that.
We're working
later.
On BEPS first.
So what are the implications then for companies, for multinationals, right, who operate around the world? And they have, to be fair, have gone to countries that have had lower corporate tax rates to their benefit. So as that changes, what's the impact on their balance sheet? What's the impact on the taxes they are paying out?
Oh, it's a great comment. The obviously taxes are a big line item ultimately
Absolutely.
On your P&L and your balance sheet, to your point, in deferreds. And so, I do look at this. When you look overall, what you hear from most companies, it's more of a shifting of where they're paying taxes.
Right.
But I would contrast that to what the OECD is saying. So their estimates on Pillar 2 roughly were $150 billion of new tax collection ultimately.
Okay.
That has been revised now up another $70 billion to $220 billion.
Okay.
So again, there's a little bit of, I think, reconciliation that's going to happen between the companies and obviously what the OECD is expected out.
So, Marna, net-net, companies, multinationals, are going to be paying more.
That's
where it's going, it's going to be different places.
Exactly. You've got it. And so I think that's what will be interesting to see shift. I think one of the big items, too, I want to make sure I'm flagging for companies and for our listeners, ultimately, is credits and incentives. So subsidies and credits and incentives that you were just talking about, whether those are green climate things that we're
seeing.
Talk
to me about that, because I was looking into a little bit of it, when it comes to sustainability goals, when it comes to your supply chains, we know that is certainly coming in the United States. You want to build something, great, but, you've got to make sure that the goods are here in the U.S.
Exactly.
Alternative energy, green energy, that's not always so easy to do.
So that is an unanswered question. So that, I think that's probably the biggest issue on companies' minds, and I think the OECD is going to have to get that settled. So how you will treat credits and incentives and subsidies. Europe tends to use more subsidies.
Right.
I'd say the U.S. and more developed countries are using more credit-type systems, and so that's not reconciled yet on whether that's in the base for your calculation of this corporate alternative minimum.
Can I ask you, the higher taxes that essentially corporations will have to pay, and I would say that there are a fair amount of people out there saying, well, it's finally corporations should be doing it, but that's a whole different argument.
That is.
but what I do wonder, is it manageable in an environment where there's lots of questions about the outlook, about growth, about pressure on balance sheets?
I do think it's manageable. I think it's a journey worth taking. I do like good tax policy. Yeah. I like consistency. Certainly our clients and taxpayers are looking for certainty.
Right.
How do they plan their operations?
What do I have to do?
These are huge capital investments companies are making, and they need to know that when they make those, they're going to have the outcome that they expected ultimately from a tax perspective.
What are you hearing from your clients, though? Then ultimately, will they be shifting around where they have operations because of this?
Yeah, so they'll always, not because of this, they will always, I've been in this business for 30 years and companies, tax doesn't drive business. Business drives business, right? They're always going to make good business decisions. But again, they're going to want to be tax efficient about how they make those investments.
But that is so interesting, because there's often the argument of no, people, tax policy does determine business decisions.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily
the case. I'd say it differently. I don't think you're ever going to make I don't think you're ever going to make a business decision solely on tax.
Right.
But there is no doubt, that if governments are trying to incent, onshoring or nearshoring right now, as an example, in sustainable, really self-sufficient, secure supply chains, they're going to encourage behavior around that, right? So we see that with the CHIPS Act on semiconductors, as an example, and obviously we're seeing it with IRA right now on climate.
One thing I wanted to ask you, and just got about 30 seconds left here, AI, ChatGPT.
Yes.
For some reason, I've got to believe that that's going to simplify, to some extent, big extent, your world.
Absolutely. I'm so excited about it. We're doubling down on it. It's when you think about it, we want to be data-enabled, tech-enabled.
Right.
And we want to be playing to our highest level degrees and our highest level thinking. And so the ability of ChatGPT-4 in particular to come in a rules-based, data-based system and really push our thinking upwards and let us do judgment and the nuances around it, I think, is extraordinary.
Oh, I love it. So
super
you guys
excited.
Are actively working on it.
We are on it.
Have you been on it before the Microsoft news?
We were. Absolutely were.
So you're hey, Microsoft, I got this.
Oh, no, we're with them. I'm totally with them. Oh, yeah.
This was really fun.
Me too. I enjoyed talking to you.
We did too. Safe travels home.
Thank you.
Marna Ricker, she's Global Vice Chair of Tax at EY, of course, the global consulting and advisory firm here at Milken. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus, global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Ken Kinsella is with us, President and CEO of Churchill Asset Management, $46 billion private capital affiliate of Nuveen here at Milken. And I'm just going to put it out because he was just talking about his own personal story and he sat down and talked about it with Barry Ritholtz. So I highly recommend everybody get the podcast because unfortunately, so you're just going to have to come back and maybe tell my audience about it. It is interesting. All I want to do is talk about your personal story. Okay, we won't do that.
It's a pretty funny story.
Talk to us. It's a great story. It like gives me hope. Yeah. It gives me hope about life.
Well, if your story inspires people, if you can inspire even one person, then it's great to tell it. And I never used to tell it. And I had one of our folks, actually Jen Prosek, who works with, runs our firm, founded our PR firm.
Yeah.
And she said, I heard your story from someone else, and she's like, you got to tell it. You got to tell your story. And I'm like, really? Do I really want to get to tell this? And she said, you absolutely should tell it. And so I have, not all the time, but I do tell it. And I think that it does inspire people. When they hear that you maybe have come from adversity or a background that is not kind of not traditional, I think there is an element to, inspiring people. And so now I tell it more often than I used to.
Well, and like I said, go to Barry Ritholtz's podcast.
Yeah, there you go.
No, but I do think there is somebody there about people who I've interviewed a lot of successful people who've done very well in life, and often their beginnings, they were living in a car at one point, or just
never lived in a car, but okay.
Or large families, lots of poverty, and it's amazing what you can do. And I do believe it gives hope. But I'm going to get yelled at if I don't ask you about kind of the environment. You do have an interesting background. You have an interesting career. You've been in the financial world for a long time.
Yes.
Going back to, I feel like, some of the iconic firms
and
of Wall Street.
The folks here. Drexel. I started my career here. And going to dinner tonight. Mike Milken does a reunion dinner every conference.
I love that.
So we all get together. And we're all frozen,
you go right back?
Ago. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Totally. Everybody resumes the position they were in in 1989, so it's kind of interesting.
It is being from a large family where you never get the pecking order. You're always either the youngest or the oldest.
And we all know what each other is doing, right? And we're all, I would say largely cheerleaders for each other. We kind of wow, that's fantastic. Look what he did. That's interesting. Maybe there's an element here that I should be looking at. So you try to learn, right? And so we were at an incredibly interesting time.
Right.
Mike was obviously leading all of that, and look what he's done here at the conference, and it's absolutely amazing. It's a great American story.
Well, how do you look at the financial markets? Where I think about it, I often say this, when Mike, the high yield market, junk bonds, it was considered, creative and something different, and
absolutely.
Now it's just part of the normal financial way, if you will. And now we look at some other different things.
How direct do you look, lending.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Each one of those has had their time, right? First, it was really the high-yield bond market because the banks really dominated, the actual lending business. Then it became more of a syndicated loan market, right? Mm-hmm. So institutional investors ultimately got involved in buying and investing in leveraged loans. And that market grew up out of basically the banks offloading a lot of their risk, right? So they were syndicating, and I like to call that the moving business, right? So they were in the moving business. First, they were in the storage business, right? It was like, oh, we make a loan, we own the loan. Then it became, oh, we're too big now, we're an investment bank, so we're going to get
this
moving business, right? So they sell to mutual funds and CLOs and everything. And it's kind of funny, we've come full circle. So the latest iteration, which is obviously our business, is direct lending. And so we've kind of taken over from the banks, right? I mean, if you think about that business today,
right?
It now, we as the largest asset managers are basically, you know, the banks are really not in our business today in any material way. And we are, you know, the ones that are actually doing the direct loans to regular way, fantastic, we hope, middle market companies. And that's what we do. So, you know, we annually as a firm invest about $12 billion in U.S. mid-sized companies.
Yeah.
I like to say that we actually do what the banks used to do.
The middle market that so often has gotten left,
which is a huge economy, by the
absolutely.
Way. Absolutely. It's the third largest economy in the world. And ironically, the regular way banks today are really not lending to it. You know, it's interesting. I mean, the regional lenders now are really focusing more on mortgages and, you know,
right.
car loans and all that stuff, credit cards. And the large-scale banks are really in the moving business, right? They're in the business of originating to distribute and asset management and other businesses and make sense for them. So it's left us in this huge market.
You're like, okay, thank you.
Right.
Right?
So direct lending today is a $1.4 or $1.5 trillion market. It is dominated by a dozen or so of the largest asset managers, direct lenders, many of them affiliated with or part of larger publicly traded companies. And, you know, we're very much in the mix. And we all kind of have our unique strategies.
Right.
I mean, we compete, but in some cases, we actually don't compete. I mean, there are very large direct lenders that we never really compete with at all. People ask us all the time, would you know those guys? And I'm like, actually, no.
So how do you minimize risk, though, then, if you are kind of all specializing in a certain area? Does that make you a little bit vulnerable?
I don't think so. I mean, I think if you think about the model, okay, and you know, I think this is one way where regulation actually accomplished, I think, something, you know, very, very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about the GFC, the banks were, certainly prior to that and even during that, the banks were actually holding a lot of loans on their balance sheet, right? And so they might do a $400 million, $500 million deal and hold $500 million on their own balance sheet.
Right. Right?
Now they're in the moving business now and everything is being sold. But what it did is it really pushed the banks away from, you know, holding such large amounts of capital on their balance sheet. And what's happened is, if you look at our business.
And only have about 25 seconds.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
We manage capital for 600 plus institutional investors, and we distribute it to those investors. So in that sense, we mitigate risk, but we can come back.
Yeah. Come back, and then maybe we'll share. I can't now.
Yeah.
But come back on air, because I'd love to continue this conversation, because
sure.
I do think this is a very important vantage point in terms of what's going on.
Great. Fantastic.
You're leaving them wanting more.
Absolutely.
Ken Kinsell, President and CEO of Churchill Asset Management, right here on Bloomberg.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.